her mouth open, but the riders were similarly agape, their swords dangling by their sides as a thunderous, whirling mass landed in the center of the platform. It was a horse, and on the horse's back was Gwyn, massive in his helmet and bark-like armor. It was his gauntleted arm that had flung Eochaid into the river, but now the rider had swum back to the platform and was climbing onto it, his movement slowed by his heavy armor. Clinging to the man's waist was Diana, her dark hair a mass of curls, pulling free of their restraints, her eyes wide. Ty got to his feet. Kit scrambled up after him. There was some blood staining the collar of Ty's hoodie. Kit realized he didn't know if it was Ty's or his own.
"Riders," Gwyn said in a thunderous voice.
There was a wide cut across his arm where Eochaid must have gotten in a blow.
"Stop!"
Diana slid from the horse's back and stalked across the concrete platform to where Eochaid was clambering out of the water. She unhitched her sword from its scabbard, spun it, and pointed it directly at his chest.
"Don't move," she said.
The rider subsided, his teeth bared in a silent snarl.
"This is none of your concern, Gwyn," said Karn. "This is unseelie business."
"The Wild Hunt bends to no law," said Gwyn. "Our will is the wind's will, and my will now is to send you away from these children. They are under my protection."
"They are Nephilim," spat Itarlum. "The architects of the Cold Peace, vicious and cruel."
"You are no better," said Gwyn. "You are the king's hunting dogs, and never have you shown any mercy."
Karn and Itarlum stared at Gwyn. Eochaid kneeling dripped on the concrete. A moment stretched out like rubber, seemingly extending forever. Eochaid shot suddenly to his feet with a gasp, seemingly heedless of Diana's sword, tracking him unerringly as he moved.
"Foul,"
he said.
"He is dead."
"That is impossible," said Karn. "Impossible. A rider cannot die."
But Itarlum let out a loud, keening cry, his sword falling to the ground as his hand flew to cover his heart.
"He is gone," he wailed. "I feel it. Our brother is gone."
"A rider has passed into the Shadowlands," said Gwyn. "Would you like me to sound the horn for him?"
Though Gwyn had sounded sincere enough to Kit, Eochaid snarled and made as if to lunge for the hunter. But Diana's sword kissed his throat as he moved, drawing blood. Thick, dark drops ran down her blade.
"Enough," said Karn. "Gwyn, you will pay for this treachery. Itar, Eochaid, to my side. We go to our brothers and sister."
Diana lowered her sword as Eochaid shouldered past her, joining the other two riders. They leapt from the platform into the air, long, soaring leaps that took them high above, where they caught the manes of their gleaming bronze horses and swung themselves up to ride. As they hurtled past above the water, Eochaid's voice echoed in Kit's ringing ears.
"I know you. I know your face."
Emma was shaking by the time they got back to the cottage. A combination of cold and reaction had set in. Her hair and clothes were plastered to her, and she suspected she looked like a drowned rat. She propped Cortana against the wall and began wearily to shuck off her drenched jacket and shoes. She was aware of Julian locking the door behind them, aware of the sounds of him moving around the room. Warmth, too. He must have built up a fire earlier. A moment later, something soft was being pressed into her hands. Julian stood in front of her, his expression unreadable, offering a slightly worn bath towel. She took it and began to dry off her hair. Jules was still wearing his damp clothes, though he was barefoot and he'd thrown on a dry sweater. Water gleamed at the edges of his hair, the tips of his eyelashes. She thought of the clang of swords on swords, the beauty of the turmoil of the battle, the sea, the sky. She wondered if that was how Mark had felt in the Wild Hunt. When there was nothing between you and the elements, it was easy to forget what weighed you down. She thought of the blood on Cortana, the blood ribboning out from under Fowl's body, mixing with the rainwater, They'd rolled his corpse under an overhang of stones, not wanting to leave him there, exposed to the weather, even though he was long past caring.
"I killed one of the riders," she said now in a near whisper.
"You had to." Julian's hand was strong on her shoulder, fingers digging in. "Emma, it was a fight to the death."
"The Clave? The Clave will understand. The fair folk won't. The Unseelie King won't."
The faintest ghost of a smile passed over Julian's face. "I don't think he likes us anyway." Emma took a tense breath.
"Fal had you backed up against the edge of the cliff," she said. "I thought he was going to kill you."
Julian's smile faded.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I'd hidden the crossbow there earlier." "I didn't know," Emma said. "It's my job to sense what's going on with you in battle, to understand it, to anticipate you. But I didn't know."
She threw the bath towel. It landed on the kitchen floor. The mug Julian had broken earlier was gone. He must have cleaned it up. Despair bubbled up inside her. Nothing she'd done had worked. They were in exactly the same place they'd been before, only Julian didn't know it. That was all that had changed.
"I tried so hard," she whispered.
His face crinkled in confusion.
"In the battle?
Emma, you did everything you could."
"Not in the battle. To make you not love me," she said. "I tried."
She felt him recoil, not so much outwardly as inwardly, as if his soul had flinched.
"Is it that awful, having me love you?"
She had started trembling again, though not from the cold.
"It was the best thing in the world," she said. "And then it was the worst. And I didn't even have a chance."
She broke off. He was shaking his head, scattering water droplets.
"You're going to have to learn to live with it," he said. "Even if it horrifies you. Even if it makes you sick. Just like I'm going to have to live with whatever other boyfriends you have. Because we are forever, no matter how, Emma, no matter what you want to call what we have, we will always be us."
"There won't be any other boyfriends," she said. He looked at her in surprise.
"What you said before, about thinking and obsessing and wanting only one thing," she said. "That's how I feel about you."
He looked stunned. She put her hands up to gently cup his face, brushing her fingers over his damp skin. She could feel the pulse hammering in his throat. There was a scratch on his face, a long one that went from his temple to his chin. Emma wondered if he'd just gotten it in the fight outside, or if he'd had it before and she hadn't noticed because she'd been trying so hard not to look at him. She wondered if he was ever going to speak again.
"Jules," she said, "say something, please."
His hands tightened convulsively on her shoulders. She gasped as his body moved against hers, walking her backward until her back hit the wall. His eyes gazed down into hers, shockingly bright, radiant as sea glass.
"Julian," he said, "I want you to call me Julian. Only ever that."
"Julian," she said, and then his mouth came down over hers, dry and burning hot, and her heart seemed to stop and start again, an engine revved into an impossibly high gear. She clutched him back with the same desperation, clinging on as he drank the rain from her mouth, her lips parting to taste him, clothes and tea. She reached to yank his sweater off over his head. Under it was a T-shirt, a thin, wet cloth, not much of a barrier when he pressed her back against the wall. His jeans were wet, too, molded to his body. She felt how much he wanted her, and wanted him just as much. The world was gone, and it was only Julian, the heat of his skin, the need to be closer to him, to fit herself against him. Every movement of his body against hers sent lightning through her nerves.
"Emma. God, Emma."
He buried his face against her, kissing her cheek, her throat, as he slid his thumbs under the waistband of her jeans and pushed down. She kicked the wet heap of denim away.
"I love you so much."
It felt as if it had been 1,000 years since that night on the beach. Her hands rediscovered his body, the hard planes of it,
his scars rough under her palms. He'd once been so skinny. She could still see him as he had been even 2 years ago, awkward and gangly. She'd loved him then, even if she hadn't known it. Loved him from the center of his bones to the surface of his skin. Now those bones were clothed and covered in smooth muscle, hard and unyielding. She ran her hands up under his shirt, relearning him, tracing him, embedding the feel and texture of him in her memory.
"Julian," she said, I love you," she was about to say. "It wasn't ever Cameron or Mark. It was always you. It will always be you. The marrow of my bones is made up of you, like cells make up our blood." But he cut her off with a hard kiss.
"Don't," he whispered. "I don't want to hear anything reasonable. Not now. I don't want logic. I want this."
"But you need to know."
He shook his head.
"I don't."
He reached down, grabbed the hem of his shirt, dragged it off. His wet hair showered droplets on them both.
"I've been broken for weeks," he said unsteadily. And she knew what that cost him, that admission of lack of control. "I need to be whole again, even if it doesn't last."
"It can't last," she said, staring at him, because how could it, when they could never keep what they had?
"It'll break our hearts."
He caught her by the wrist, brought her hand to his bare chest, splayed her fingers over his heart. It beat against her palm, like a fist punching its way through his sternum.
"Break my heart," he said. "Break it into pieces. I give you permission."
The blue of his eyes had almost disappeared behind the expanding rims of his pupils. She hadn't known before on the beach what was going to happen, what it would be like between them. Now she did. There were things in life you couldn't refuse. No one had that much willpower.
No one.
She was nodding her head without even knowing she was going to do it.
"Julian, yes," she said. "Yes."
She heard him make an almost anguished sound. Then his hands were on her hips. He was lifting her so she was pinned between his body and the wall. It felt desperate, world-ending, and she wondered if there would ever be a time when it wouldn't, when it could be soft and slow and quietly loving. He kissed her fiercely, and she forgot gentleness or any desire for it. There was only this, his whispering her name as they pushed aside the clothes that needed to be pushed aside. He was gasping, a faint sheen of sweat on his skin, damp hair plastered to his forehead. He lifted her higher, pressed toward her so fast his body collided with hers. She heard the ragged moan dragged out of his throat. When he lifted his face, eyes black with desire, she stared at him, wide-eyed.
"You all right?"
he whispered. She nodded.
"Don't stop."
His mouth found hers, unsteady, his hands shaking where they held her. She could tell he was fighting for every second of control. She wanted to tell him it was fine, it was all right. But coherence had deserted her. She could hear the waves outside, smashing brutally against the rocks. She closed her eyes and heard him say that he loved her. And then her arms were around him, holding him as his knees gave way and they sank to the floor, clutching each other like the survivors of a ship that had run aground on some distant, legendary shore. Tavi, Rafe, and Max were easy enough to locate. They'd been in the care of Bridget, who was amusing them by letting them annoy Jessamine so that she knocked things off high shelves, thus sparking a do-not-tease-ghosts lecture from Magnus. Drew, on the other hand, was nowhere to be found. She wasn't in her bedroom any longer, or hiding in the library or the parlor, and the kids hadn't seen her. Possibly Jessamine could have helped them more, but Bridget had reported that she had flounced off after the children were done bothering her, and besides, she only liked talking to Kit. "Drew wouldn't leave the Institute, would she?" Mark said. He was stalking down the corridor, shoving doors open left and right. "Why would she do something like that?"
"Mark."
Kieran took the other boy by his shoulders and turned him so that they faced each other. Christina felt a throb in her wrist, as if Mark's distress were communicating itself to her through the binding. Of course, Mark and Kieran shared another kind of binding, the binding of shared experience and emotion.
Kieran was holding Mark by the shoulders, concentrating on nothing but him in that way that fairies had. And Mark was relaxing slowly, some of the tension leaving his body.
Your sister is here, said Kieran, and we will find her.
We'll split up and look, said Alec. Magnus?
Magnus swung Max up into his arms and headed down the hallway, the other two kids trailing behind him. The rest of them agreed to meet back in the library in 20 minutes. Each of them got a quadrant of the Institute to search. Christina wound up with West, which took her downstairs into the ballroom. She wished it hadn't. The memories of dancing there with Mark and then with Kieran were confusing and distracting. And she didn't need to be distracted now. She needed to find Drew. She headed down the stairs and froze. There on the landing was Drusilla, all in black, her brown braids tied with black ribbon. She turned a pale, anxious face to Christina.
I was waiting for you, she said.
Everyone's looking for you, Christina said. Ty and Livy.
I know, I heard. I was listening, said Drew.
But you weren't in the library.
Please, Drew said. You have to come with me. There's not a lot of time.
She turned and hurried up the stairs. After a moment, Christina followed her.
Drew? Mark's worried. The riders are terribly dangerous. He needs to know you're all right.
I'll go and tell him I'm fine in a second, Drew said. But I need you to come with me.
Drew...
They made it to the hallway where most of the spare bedrooms were.
Look, said Drew, I just need you to do this, okay? If you try yelling for Mark, I promise you there are places in this institute I can hide where you won't find me for days.
Christina couldn't help being curious.
How do you know the institute so well?
You would too if every time you showed your face someone tried to make you babysit, said Drew. They'd reached her bedroom. She stood hesitating with her hand on the knob of the door.
But we looked in your bedroom, Christina protested.
I'm telling you, said Drew, hiding places.
She took a deep breath.
Okay, you go in there and don't freak out.
Drew's small face was set and determined, as if she were nerving herself to do something unpleasant.
Is everything all right? Christina said.
Are you sure you wouldn't rather talk to Mark than me?
It isn't me who wants to talk to you, Drew said. And pushed her bedroom door open.
Christina stepped inside, feeling more puzzled than ever. She only saw a shadow first, a figure in front of the windowsill. Then he stood up and her heart caught in her throat. Brown skin, tangled black hair, sharp features, long lashes. The faint slouch to the shoulders she remembered that she used to tell him always made him look as if he were walking into a high wind.
Jaime! She breathed.
He reached out his arms, and a moment later she was hugging him tightly. Jaime had always been skinny, but now he felt positively prickly with pointed collarbones and sharp elbows. He hugged her back tightly, and Christina heard the bedroom door close quietly, the lock clicking. She pulled back and looked up into Jaime's face. He looked like he always did, bright-eyed, edged with mischief.
So, he said, you really missed me.
All the night she'd stayed up sobbing because of him, because he was missing, because she hated him, because he'd been her best friend and she hated hating him. Burst. Her left palm cracked against his cheek, and then she was hitting him on the shoulders and the chest, wherever she could reach.
Ow! He writhed away. That hurts!
Me vale madre! She hit him again.
How dare you disappear like that? Everyone was worried. I thought maybe you were dead. And now... You turn up hiding in Drusilla Blackthorne's bedroom? Which, by the way, if her brothers find out, they will kill you dead.
It wasn't like that.
Jaime windmilled his arms as if to fend off her blows.
I was looking for you.
She put her hands on her hips.
After all this time avoiding me, suddenly you're looking for me?
It wasn't you I was avoiding, he said. He took a crumpled envelope out of his pocket and held it up to her. With a pang, she recognized Diego's handwriting.
If Diego wants to write to me, he doesn't need the message hand-delivered, she said. What does he think you are, a carrier pigeon?
He can't write to you, said Jaime. Zara watches all his mail.
So you know about Zara?
Christina said, taking the envelope.
How long?
Jaime slouched back against a large oak desk, hands propped behind him.
How long have they been engaged?
Since you two broke up the first time.
But it's not a real engagement, Christina. She sat down on Drew's bed. It seemed real enough. Jaime ran a hand through his black hair. He looked only a little like Diego, maybe in the set of his mouth, the shape of his eyes. Jaime had always been playful where Diego was serious. Now, tired and skinny, he resembled the glum, style-conscious boys who hung around coffee shops in the Colonia Roma.
"I know you probably hate me," he said. "You've got every reason. You think I wanted our branch of the family to take over the Institute because I wanted power and didn't care about you. But the fact is, I had a good reason."
"I don't believe you," Christina said.
Jaime made an impatient noise.
"I'm not self-sacrificing, Tina," he said. "That's Diego, not me. I wanted our family to be out of trouble."
Christina dug her hands into the bedspread.
"What kind of trouble?" "You know we've always had a connection with the fairies," said Jaime. "It's where that necklace of yours comes from. But there's always been more to it than that. Most of it didn't matter until the cold piece. Then the family was supposed to turn everything over to the Clave, all their information, anything the fairies had ever given them. But they didn't," Christina guessed.
"They didn't," said Jaime.
"They decided the relationship with the Adas was more important than the cold piece."
He shrugged fluidly.
"There's an heirloom. It has power even I don't understand. The Dearborns and the cohort demanded it. And we told them only a Rosales could make the object work."
Realization came to Christina with a hard shock.
"So the fake engagement," she said. "So Zara could think she was becoming a Rosales."
"Exactly," said Jaime. "Diego ties himself to the cohort, and I take the heirloom and run. So Diego can blame me. His bad little brother ran off with it. And the engagement drags on, and they don't find the heirloom."
"Is that your only plan?" Christina said. "Delay forever?"
Jaime frowned at her.
"I don't think you entirely appreciate that I've been very bravely on the run for months now," he said. "Very bravely."
"We are Nephilim, Jaime. It's our job to be brave," Christina said.
"Some of us are better at it than others," Jaime said. "Anyway, I want to say our whole plan is to delay. No. Diego works to find out what the cohort's weaknesses are, and I find out what the heirloom does, exactly."
"You don't know?"
He shook his head.
"I know it helps you enter Faerie undetected."
"And the cohort wants to be able to enter Faerie so they can start a war," Christina guessed.
"That would make sense," said Jaime. "To them, anyway."
Christina sat on the bed in silence. Outside it had begun to rain. Water streaked the window panes. She thought of rain on the trees in the bosque, and sitting there with Jaime, watching him eat bags of Dorilocos and lick the salt off his fingers. And talking for hours, about literally everything, about what they would do when they were Parabatai and could travel anywhere in the world.
"Where are you going to go?"
she said finally, trying to keep her voice steady.
"I can't tell you." He pulled himself away from the desk. "I can't tell anyone. I'm a good escape artist, Christina, but only if I never tell where I'm hiding."
"You don't know, do you?" she said.
"You're going to improvise."
He smiled sideways.
"No one knows me better than you."
"And Diego?"
Christina's voice shook.
"Why didn't he ever tell me this?"
"People do stupid things when they're in love," said Jaime in the voice of someone who had never been. "And besides, I asked him not to."
"So why are you telling me now?"
"Two things," he said. "In Downworld, they say the Blackthorns are going up against the cohort. If it comes to a fight, I want to be in it. Send me a fire message. I will come."
His tone was earnest.
"And secondly, to deliver Diego's message. He said you might be too angry to read it, but I was hoping that now he would not be."
She looked down at the envelope in her hand. It had been bent and folded many times.
"I'll read it," she said quietly. "Won't you stay? Eat a meal with us. You look starved."
Jaime shook his head.
"No one can know I was here, Tina. Promise me. On the fact that we were once going to be Parabatai."
"That isn't fair," she whispered. "Besides, Drusilla knows."
"She won't tell anyone," Jaime began.
Christina? It was Mark's voice echoing down the hallway. Christina, where are you?
Jaime's arms were around her suddenly, wiry strong as he hugged her hard. When he let go, she touched his face lightly. There were a million things she wanted to say. Ten cuidado, more than anything. Be safe. Be careful. But he was already turning away from her toward the window. He threw it open and ducked outside like a shadow, vanishing into the rain-streaked night. Chapter 25. Start and Sigh. Gwen wouldn't come into the Institute. Kid didn't know if it was principle or preference, but despite the fact that his arm was bleeding, soaking the side of his armor, the Wild Hunt leader only shook his head when Alec invited him cordially into the Institute. I am the head of the London Institute, however temporarily, Alec said. I am empowered to invite whoever I want inside.
I cannot linger, Gwyn demurred. There is much to be done.
It had begun to rain. Alec was on the roof along with Mark, who had greeted Livy and Ty with a mixture of terror and relief. The twins were still standing close to their brother, his arm around Livy's shoulder, his hand clasping Ty's sleeve. There was no one to greet Kit that way. He stood off a little to the side, watching. The ride on horseback from the river, Gwen seemed to be able to summon horses out of the air like a magician conjuring pennies, had been a blur. Ty and Livy had ridden with Diana, and Kit had wound up behind Gwen, clinging desperately to his belt and trying not to fall off the horse into the Thames.
I cannot stay among all this cold iron, Gwen said, and he did look fairly piqued, in Kit's opinion.
And you, Blackthorns, you should get yourself inside the Institute. Within its walls you are safe.
What about Emma and Jules? Livy said. They could be outside. The riders could be looking for them.
Magnus went to find them, Alec reassured her. He'll make sure they're all right.
Livy nodded gravely, but she still looked worried.
We might need some help from you, Diana, said Alec. We're sending the children to Alicante as soon as Magnus returns.
Which children? Asked Diana. She had a soft, low voice. Now it was rough with tiredness.
Just yours or...
Tabby and Drusilla as well, Alec said. He eyed Livy and Ty. Kit guessed that if he had his druthers, Alec would bring the twins along too, but he knew they'd never stand for it.
Ah, said Diana. Might I suggest that rather than taking up residence with the Inquisitor in Alicante, you stay with me on Flintlock Street? It would be good if the cohort didn't know you were there.
My thought exactly, said Alec. Better to stay under the radar of the Dearborns and their ilk, especially just before the council meeting. He frowned.
And hopefully we'll be able to get the binding spell off Mark and Christina before we need to leave. Otherwise they might not be able to...
One of the riders was killed, Kit said.
Everyone stared at him. He wasn't sure why he'd spoken himself. The world seemed to be swaying around him, and strange things were important.
You remember, he said. That's why they fled in the end. One of them had died, and the others could feel it. Maybe Julian and Emma fought with them and won.
No one can kill one of the riders of Manon, said Gwyn.
Emma could, said Livy. If Cortana...
Kit's knees gave out. It was very sudden, and he hadn't expected it at all. One moment he was standing, the next he was kneeling in a cold puddle, wondering why he couldn't get up.
Kit! Diana cried. Alec, he hit his head during the fight. He said it didn't hurt, but...
Alec was already striding over to Kit. He was stronger than he looked. His arms braced Kit, lifting him. A hot dart of pain went through Kit's head as he moved, and a merciful grayness closed in. They lay on the bed afterward in the twilight dark, Emma with her head on Julian's chest. She could hear his heart beating through the soft material of his T-shirt. They had toweled their hair and put on dry clothes and curled up together under one layer of blankets. Their feet were tangled together. Julian was running a slow, thoughtful hand through her loose hair.
Tell me, he said. You said there was something I needed to know, and I stopped you. He paused. Tell me now.
She folded her arms on his chest, resting her chin on them. There was relaxation in the curve of his body around hers. but his expression was more than curious. She could see the intensity in the back of his eyes, his need to know, to make sense out of all the pieces that didn't make sense now. "I was never dating Mark," she said. "That was all a lie. I asked him to pretend to be dating me, and he had said he owed me his life before, so he agreed. It was never real." His fingers stilled in her hair. Emma swallowed. She had to get through all this without thinking of whether Julian would hate her at the end, otherwise she'd never be able to finish. "Why would you do that?" he said carefully. "Why would Mark agree to hurt me?"
"He didn't know he was hurting you," Emma said. "He never knew there was anything between us, not until we went to Ferry. He found out then, and he told me we had to end it. That's why I stopped things in London. Mark didn't mind. We didn't feel that way about each other."
"So Mark didn't know," he said. "Why did you do it, then?" He held up a hand. "Never mind, I know the answer. To stop me loving you. To break us up. I even know why you picked Mark."
"I wish it could have been anyone else."
"No one else would have made me hate you," he said flatly. "Nobody else would have made me give you up." He propped himself up on his elbow, looking down at her. "Make me understand," he said. "You love me, and I love you, but you wanted to wreck all that. You were so determined you brought Mark into it, which I know you'd never do if you weren't desperate."
"So what made you desperate, Emma?
I know being in love with your parapetai is forbidden, but it's a stupid law."
"It's not," she said, "a stupid law."
He blinked. His hair was dry now. "Whatever you know, Emma," he said in a low voice, "it's time to tell me." So she did, leaving nothing out. She told him what Malcolm had said to her about the parapetai curse, about how he was showing her mercy, killing her, when otherwise she and Julian would watch each other die, how the Nephilim hated love, what Jem had confirmed for her, the terrible fate of parapetai who fell in love, the death and destruction they would bring down around them, how she knew that neither of them could ever become mundanes or downworlders to break the bond, how being shadow hunters was part of their souls and their selves, how the exile from their families would destroy them. The light from the fire threw a dark gold glow across his face, his hair, but she could see how pale he was, even under that, and the starkness that took over his expression as she spoke, as if the shadows were growing harsher. Outside, the rain poured steadily down. When she was done, he was silent for a long time. Emma's mouth was dry, as if she'd been swallowing cotton. Finally, she could stand it no longer and move toward him, knocking the pillow onto the floor.
"Jules," he held a hand up,
"why didn't you tell me any of this?" She looked at him miserably.
"Because of what Jem said. That finding out that what we had was forbidden for good reason would just make it worse."
"Believe me, knowing what I know hasn't made me love you any less." His eyes were such a dark blue in the dim light they looked like Kit's. "So you decided to make me hate you?"
"I tried," she whispered. "I didn't know what else to do."
"But I could never hate you," he said. "Hating you would be like hating the idea of good things ever happening in the world. It would be like death. I thought you didn't love me, Emma. But I never hated you.
And I thought you didn't love me.
And it didn't make any difference, did it? We still loved each other. I understand why you were so upset about what we did to Port Hollow Church now." She nodded.
"The curse makes you stronger before it makes you destructive."
"I'm glad you told me." He touched her cheek, her hair.
"Now we know nothing we can do will change how we feel about each other. We'll have to find another solution."
There were tears on Emma's face, though she didn't remember starting to cry.
"I thought if you stopped loving me, you'd be sad for a while. And if I was sad forever, that'd be okay. Because you'd be all right. And I'd still be your parapetai. And if you could be happy eventually, I could be happy, too, for you.
You're an idiot, Julian said. He put his arms around her and rocked her, his lips against her hair, and he whispered, the way he whispered when Tavi had nightmares, that she was brave to have done what she did, that they'd fix it all, they'd find a way. And even though Emma could still see no way out for them, she relaxed against his chest, letting herself feel the relief of having shared the burden just for this moment. But I can't be angry. There's something I should have told you as well. She drew away from him.
What is it?
He was fiddling with his glass bracelet. Since Julian rarely expressed any anxiety in a visible way, Emma felt her heart thump.
Julian, she said, tell me.
When we were going into Faerie, he said in a low voice, the Pooka told me that if I entered the lands, I would meet someone who knew how to break the Parapetai bond. The thumping of Emma's heart became a rapid tattoo, beating against the inside of her rib cage. She sat up straight.
Are you saying you know how to break it?
He shook his head. The wording was correct. I met someone who did know how to break it. The Seelie Queen, to be precise. She told me she knew it could be done, but not how.
Is that part of returning the book? Emma said.
We give her the black volume. She tells us how to end the bond. He nodded. He was looking at the fire.
You didn't tell me, she said. Is that because you thought I wouldn't care?
Partially, he said. If you didn't want the bond broken, then neither did I. I'd rather be your Parapetai than nothing.
Jules.
Julian. And there's more, he said. She told me there would be a cost.
Of course,
a cost. There's always a cost when fairies are involved.
What kind of cost? She whispered.
Breaking the bond involves using the black volume to dig out the root of all Parapetai ceremonies, said Julian. It would break our bond, yes, but it would also destroy every Parapetai bond in the world. They'd all be snapped. There'd be no more Parapetai.
Emma stared at him in absolute shock.
We couldn't possibly do that. Alec and Jace, Clary and Simon, there are so many others. You think I don't know that? But I couldn't not tell you. You have a right to know.
Emma felt as if she could barely breathe.
The Queen, a sharp bang echoed through the room as if someone had set off a firecracker. Magnus Bane appeared in their kitchen, wrapped in a long black coat, his right hand sparking blue fire, his expression thunderous.
"Why in the names of the Nine Princes of Hell are neither of you answering your phone?" he demanded.
Emma and Julian gaped at him. After a moment, he gaped back.
"My God," he said. "Are you..."
He didn't finish the question. He didn't have to. Emma and Julian scrambled out of the bed. They were both mostly dressed, but Magnus was looking at them as if he'd caught them in flagrante.
"Magnus," Julian said. He didn't follow up his greeting by saying it wasn't like that, or Magnus was getting the wrong idea. Julian didn't say things like that. "What's going on? Is something wrong at home?"
Magnus looked at the moment like he was feeling his age.
"Parapetai," he said, and sighed.
"Yes, something's wrong. We need to get you back to the Institute. Grab your things and get ready to leave."
He leaned back against the kitchen island, crossing his arms. He was wearing a sort of great coat with several layers of short capes in the back. He was dry. He must have portaled from the inside of the Institute.
"There's blood on your sword, Emma," he said, looking at where Cortana was propped against the wall.
"Fairy blood," said Emma.
Julian was yanking on a sweater and running his fingers through his wild hair.
"When you say fairy blood," Magnus said, "you mean the riders, don't you?"
Emma saw Julian start.
"They were looking for us."
"How would you know?"
"They weren't just looking for you. The king sent them to find the black volume. He instructed them to hunt all of you. All the Blackthorns."
"To hunt us?" Julian demanded. "Is anyone hurt?"
He strode across the room to Magnus, almost as if he meant to grab the warlock by his shirt and shake him.
"Is anyone in my family hurt?"
Julian. Magnus's voice was firm. Everyone's fine. But the Riders did come. They attacked Kit and Ty and Livy.
And they're all right?
Emma demanded anxiously, shoving her feet into her boots. Yes. I got a fire message from Alec, Magnus said. Kit got a bump on the head. Ty and Livy, not a scratch. But they were lucky. Gwen and Diana intervened.
Diana and Quinn, together?
Emma was baffled. Emma killed one of the Riders, Julian said. He was gathering up Annabelle's portfolio, Malcolm's diaries, shoving them into his bag. We hid his body up on the cliff, but we probably shouldn't leave it there. Magnus whistled between his teeth. No one's killed one of Manon's Riders in, well, in all the history I know. Emma shuddered, remembering the cold feeling as the blade had gone into Fowl's body. It was horrible. The rest of them are not gone forever, said Magnus. They will be back. Julian zipped his bag and Emma's.
Then we need to take the children somewhere safe, somewhere the Riders can't find them.
Right now, the Institute is the safest place outside Idris, said Magnus. It's warded, and I'll ward it again.
The cottage is safe, too, Emma said, hoisting her bag over her shoulder.
It was twice as heavy as it had been before, with the addition of Malcolm's books. The Riders can't come near it. They said so.
Thoughtful of Malcolm, said Magnus. But you'd be trapped inside the house if you stayed, and I can't imagine you'd want to be unable to leave these four walls.
No, Julian said, but he said it quietly. Emma could see Magnus raking his gaze over the interior of the cottage. The mess of teacups they hadn't cleaned up, the signs of Julian's cooking, the disarray of bed covers, the remains of a fire in the grate. The place built by and for two people who loved each other yet weren't allowed to, and that had sheltered two more such people 200 years later. I suppose we wouldn't. There was sympathy in Magnus's eyes when he looked back at Julian and at Emma, too. All dreams end when you wake, he said. Now come, I'll portal us home.
Drew watched the rain streak her bedroom windows. Outside, London was a blur, the glow of streetlights expanding in the rain to become yellow dandelion clocks of light perched on elongated metal posts. She had been in the library long enough to tell Mark that she was fine before he'd gotten worried about Christina and gone looking for her. When they'd both returned, Drew's stomach had tightened with fear. She'd been sure Christina was going to tell everyone about Jaime, spill her secret, spill his. The expression on Christina's face wasn't comforting, either.
"Can I talk to you in the hall, Drew?" she had said.
Drew nodded and put her book down. She hadn't been reading it anyway. Mark had gone over to Kieran and the children, and Drew followed Christina out into the hall.
"Thank you," Christina said as soon as the door was shut, "for helping Jaime."
Drew cleared her throat. Being thanked seemed like a good sign, at least a sign that Christina wasn't mad. Maybe. Christina smiled. She had dimples. Drew immediately wished she had them, too.
Did she?
She'd have to check. Though smiling at herself in the mirror sounded a little bizarre.
"Don't worry. I won't tell anyone he was here or that you helped him."
It must not have been easy, putting up with him as you did.
"I didn't mind," Drew said. "He listened to me."
Christina's dark eyes were sad.
"He used to listen to me once, too." "Is he going to be all right?" Drew asked.
"I think so," Christina said. "He has always been smart and careful."
She touched Drew's cheek.
"I'll let you know if I hear from him."
And that was that. Drew had gone back to her bedroom, feeling hollow. She knew she was supposed to stay in the library, but she needed to be where she could think. She sat on the edge of her bed, kicking her legs listlessly. She wanted Jaime to be there so she'd have someone to talk to. She wanted to talk about the fact that Magnus looked tired, that Mark was stressed, that she was worried about Emma and Jules. She wanted to talk about how she missed home, the smell of ocean and desert. She swung her legs harder, and her heel collided with something. Bending down, she saw with surprise that Jaime's duffel bag was still stuffed under her bed. She pulled it out from under the mattress, trying not to spill the contents. It was already unzipped. He must have shoved it there in a hurry when Christina came in. But why would he leave it?
Did it mean he was planning on coming back? Or had he just left behind the stuff he didn't need? She didn't mean to look inside, or at least that was what she told herself later. It wasn't that she needed to know if he was coming back. It was just an accident. Stuffed inside were a jumble of boys' clothes, a bunch of jeans and shirts, a few books, spare steelies, unactivated serif blades, a Bali song not unlike Christina's, and some photographs. And something else, something that shone brightly that she thought for a moment was a witch light, but the illumination was far less white than that. It glowed with a dim, deep gold color, like the surface of the ocean. Before she knew it, her hand was on it. She felt herself jerked off her feet, as if she were being sucked into a portal. She yanked her hand back, but she was no longer touching anything. She was no longer in the room at all. She was underground, in a long corridor dug out of the earth. The roots of trees grew down into the space, like the curling ribbon on expensively wrapped gifts. The corridor stretched away to either side of her, into shadows that deepened like no shadows above ground. Drew's heart was pounding. A terrible sense of unreality choked her. It was as if she traveled through a portal, but with no idea where she'd gone, and no sense of familiarity. Even the air in the place smelled like something strange and dark, some kind of scent she'd never breathed before. Drew reached automatically for the weapons in her belt, but there was nothing there. She'd come here completely unprepared, in only jeans and a black T-shirt with cats on it. She choked back a hysterical laugh and moved to press herself against the wall of the underground corridor, keeping to the depth of the shadows. Lights appeared at the end of the hall. Drew could hear high, sweet voices in the distance. Their chatter was like the chatter of birds. Fairies. She moved blindly in the other direction and nearly fell backward when the wall gave way behind her and became a curtain of fabric. She stumbled through and found herself in a large stone room. The walls were squares of green marble, veined with thick black lines. Some of the squares were carved with golden patterns, a hawk, a throne, a crown divided into two pieces. There were weapons in the room, ranged around on the surfaces of different tables, swords and daggers of copper and bronze, hooks and spikes and maces of all sorts of metal, except iron. There was also a boy in the room. A boy her age, maybe 13. He had turned around when she came in, and now he stared at her in astonishment. "How dare you come into this room?" His voice was sharp, imperious. He wore rich clothing, silk and velvet, heavy leather boots. His hair was white blonde, the color of witchlight. It was cut short, and a pale band of metal encircled it at his brow. "I didn't mean to," Drew swallowed. "I just want to get out of here," she said. "That's all I want." His green eyes burned. "Who are you?" He took a step forward, snatching a dagger up off the table beside him. "Are you a shadow hunter?" Drew raised her chin and stared back at him. "Who are you?" she demanded. "And why are you so rude?" To her surprise, he smiled, and there was something familiar about it. "I'm Cold Ash," he said. "Did my mother send you?" He sounded hopeful. "Is she worried about me?"
"Drusilla," said a voice.
"Drew!
Drew!"
Drew looked around in confusion. Where was the voice coming from? The walls of the room were starting to darken, to melt and merge. The boy in the rich clothes with his sharp fairy's face looked at her in confusion, raising his dagger as more holes began to open around her, in the walls, in the floor. She shrieked as the ground gave way beneath her, and she fell into darkness. The whirling air caught her again, the cold spinning almost portal, and then she slammed back to reality on the floor of her bedroom. She was alone. She gasped and choked, trying to pull herself to her knees. Her heart felt as if it were going to rip its way out of her chest. Her mind spun. The terror of being underground. The terror of not knowing if she'd ever return home. The terror of an alien place. And yet the images slipped away from her,
as if she were trying to hold on to water or wind. Where was I? What happened? She raised herself to her knees, feeling sick and nauseated. She blinked away the dizziness. There were green eyes in the back of her vision. Green eyes. And saw that Jaime's duffel bag was gone. Her window was propped open, the floor damp below the window. He must have come in and out while she was gone. But where had she been? She didn't remember.
Drew?
The voice came again, Mark's voice, and another impatient knock on her door.
Drew, did you hear me? Emma and Jules are back.
There, Diana said, checking the bandage on Gwyn's arm one last time. I wish I could give you an Arazi, but... She let her voice trail off, feeling silly. She was the one who had insisted they go to her rooms in Alicante so she could bandage his wound, and Gwyn had been quiet ever since. He had slapped his horse's flank after they'd climbed from it into her window, sending it soaring into the sky. She'd wondered as he looked around her room, his bicolored eyes taking in all the visible traces of her life, the used coffee mugs, the pajamas thrown into a corner, the ink-stained desk, whether she'd made the right decision bringing him here. She had let so few people into her personal space for so many years, showing only what she wanted to show, controlling access to her inner self so carefully. She had never thought the first man she allowed into her room in Idris would be an odd and beautiful fairy, but she knew when he winced violently as he sat down on her bed that she'd made the right call. She'd gritted her teeth in sympathetic pain as he started to peel away his bark-like armor. Her father had always kept extra bandages in the bathroom. When she returned from her trip there, gauze in hand, she found Gwyn, shirtless and grumpy-looking on her rumpled blanket, his brown hair almost the same color as her wooden walls. His skin was several shades paler, smooth and taut over bones that were just a shade alien.
"I do not need to be ministered to," he said. "I've always bandaged my own wounds."
Diana didn't answer, just set about making the field dressing. Sitting behind him as she worked, she realized it was the closest she'd ever been to him. She thought his skin would feel like bark, like his armor, but it didn't. It felt like leather, the very softest kind that was used to make scabbards for delicate blades. "We all have wounds that are sometimes better cared for by someone else," she said, setting the box of bandages aside.
"And what of your wounds?" he said.
"I wasn't injured." She got to her feet, ostensibly to prove to him that she was fine, walking and breathing. Part of it was also to put some distance between them. Her heart was skipping beats in a way she didn't trust.
"You know that's not what I meant," he said. "I see how you care for those children. Why do you not just offer to head the Los Angeles Institute? You would make a better leader than Arthur Blackthorne ever did."
Diana swallowed, though her mouth was dry. "Does it matter?"
"It matters in that I wish to know you," he said. "I would kiss you, but you draw away from me. I would know your heart, but you hide it in shadow. Is it that you do not like or want me? Because in that case I will not trouble you."
There was no intention to cause guilt in his voice, only a plain statement of fact. If he had made a more emotional plea, perhaps she would not have responded. As it was, she found herself crossing the room, picking up a book from the shelf by the bed. "If you think there's something I'm hiding, then I suppose you're right," she said. "But I doubt it's what you think." She raised her chin, thinking of her namesake, goddess and warrior, who had nothing to apologize for. "It's nothing I did wrong. I'm not ashamed. I have no reason to be. But the clave," she sighed. "Here, take this." Gwyn took the book from her, solemn-faced.
"This is a book of law," he said.
She nodded. "The laws of investiture. It details the ceremonies by which shadow hunters take on new positions, how one is sworn in as consul or inquisitor or the head of an institute." She leaned over him, opening the book to a well-examined page. "Here. When you're sworn in as the head of an institute, you must hold the mortal sword and answer the inquisitor's questions. The questions are law. They never change." Gwyn nodded.
Which of the questions is it, he said, that you do not want to answer? Pretend that you are the Inquisitor, Diana said, as if he hadn't spoken. Ask the questions, and I will answer as if I'm holding the sword, entirely truthfully. Gwyn nodded. His eyes were dark with curiosity and something else as he began to read aloud.
Are you a shadow hunter?
Yes, said Diana.
Were you born a shadow hunter, or did you ascend?
I was born a shadow hunter.
What is your family name?
Rayburn.
And what was the name you were given at birth? Asked Gwyn.
David, said Diana. David Lawrence Rayburn. Gwyn looked puzzled.
I do not understand.
I am a woman, said Diana. I always have been. I always knew I was a girl, whatever the Silent Brothers told my parents, whatever the contradiction of my body. My sister, Arya, knew too. She said she'd known it from the moment I could talk. But my parents... She broke off. They weren't unkind, but they didn't know the options. They told me I should live as myself at home, but in public, be David. Be the boy I knew I wasn't. Stay under the radar of the Clave. I knew that would be living a lie. Still, it was a secret the four of us kept. Yet with every year, my crushing despair grew. I withdrew from interaction with other shadow hunters our age. At every moment, waking and sleeping, I felt anxious and uncomfortable. And I feared I would never be happy. Then I turned 18. My sister was 19. We went to Thailand together to study at the Bangkok Institute. I met Katerina Loss there.
Katerina Loss, said Gwyn. She knows that you were...
He frowned.
I'm sorry. I don't know how to say it. That you were named David by your parents.
She knows, Diana said. She didn't know it at the time. In Thailand, I lived as the woman I am. I dressed as myself. Arya introduced me as her sister. I was happy. For the first time, I felt free. And I chose a name for myself that embraced that freedom. My father's weapon shop had always been called Diana's Arrow, after the goddess of the hunt, who was proud and free. I named myself Diana. I am Diana. She took a ragged breath. And then my sister and I went out to explore an island where it was rumored there were Toxicon demons. It turned out not to be demons at all, but revenants, hungry ghosts, dozens of them. We fought them, but we were both injured. Katerina rescued us, rescued me. When I woke up in a small house not far away, Katerina was caring for us. I knew she'd seen my injuries, that she'd seen my body. I knew she knew.
Diana, said Gwyn in his deep voice, and stretched out a hand, but Diana shook her head.
Don't, she said, or I won't be able to get through it. Her eyes were burning with unshed tears. I pulled the rags of my clothes around my body. I screamed for my sister, but she was dead. Had died while Katerina ministered to her. I broke down completely then. I had lost everything. My life was destroyed. That's what I thought. A tear slipped down her face. Katerina nursed me back to health and sanity. I was in that cottage with her for weeks. And she talked to me. She gave me words, which I'd never had as a gift. It was the first time I heard the word transgender. I broke into tears. I'd never realized before how much you can take from someone by not allowing them the words they need to describe themselves. How can you know there are other people like you when you've never had a name to call yourself? I know there must have been other transgender shadow hunters, that they must have existed in the past and exist now. But I have no way to search for them, and it would be dangerous to ask. A flicker of anger at the old injustice sharpened her voice. Then Katerina told me of transitioning, that I could live as myself, the way I needed to, and be acknowledged as who I am. I knew it was what I wanted. I went with Katerina to Bangkok, but not as David. I went as Diana.
and I did not go as a shadow hunter. I live